that's exactly what happened.
24 hours later, they used the RV.
Very good. Shepherd, his name was.
Disciplined too, as well.
Absolutely.
Just did exactly as he thought. But I should imagine quite a frightening thing for an 18-year-old.
And what would have been for me at 18?
Well, I mean, not only that. I mean, he had a map.
That's right.
And it is actually very... the moment for panic. What shall I do?
Yes, exactly.
And training and discipline.
What you're told.
To go to the RV.
Absolutely.
And then presumably, if he hadn't been picked up there that day, he'd have gone to the normal turn. He'd have gone to the next RV.
Yes, yes.
The normal routine of any spending 24 hours in the RV.
Each patrol, as you know, had a Saudi beacon.
Right.
But he didn't, actually.
Right, yeah. And of course, presumably, he was across the border.
That's right.
Obviously,
that's
so there's no question of just flying helicopters across, because that would have been a complete disaster.
When I came here, in one of my interviews for this job, the RV job, and Sir John Grandy was constable. And he saw me, and he said, my papers are done. I said, I see you, SAS, and I said, yes, sir. And he said, then you're taking my helicopters where they ought not to have gone. And I said, well, sir, we won't say any more about that. Yes, he couldn't.
I mean, it's actually common knowledge. In fact.
Yes, of course. Well, ill-defined maps.
Quite. Map reading errors.
That's right.
Now, that's very interesting, because... the company did... Were there many casualties in the company during those tours?
None at all.
None at all?
Were you involved in it as well?
Yes, but I mean, I was on the staff.
Yes.
I never operated in Borneo. I went out... I used to get involved in some of those operations because I had to, because of my staff what I was doing.
So were you at Labuan? Were you on
I went around.
Yes.
But I was on a station.
That was the first act of service I ever heard commanding officers sort of beating his drum, musket people back without cavalry. That was the first time I ever heard it.
Yeah, before that, it was.
That's right. A bit of front post stuff,
right?
I wonder why that was.
Well, I think, when you think about it, was it really what most soldiers on?
Probably not.
If you'd had a commando then or something like that,
Yes, I mean, my line... No, I didn't think it would have been. My line would have been, we are doing a very good job here, which was very necessary.
That's right.
Which is actually protecting Malaysia. But one wasn't going to do things that were going to cause casualties
unnecessarily.
And obviously, if you went on operations that were across the border and there were going to be contacts there, you ran the risk of there being casualties.
Yes.
But I think it was important to weigh up whether the outcome was worth the risk. I think casualties. I think that permeated throughout the British Army in Borneo.
Yes,
casualties were very low.
Yes.
Actually, when you think of the risks that were taken in some instances.
But that's just the first operation that I ever heard that, sort of... the thing was, I visited my first town for some hour and a half, instead of going to Bangkok or somewhere nice, I went on to visit our first town.
Right.
And come half to flesh was my...
Right.
It's the first thing. I had no casualties.
Should have thought of that in the first war, shouldn't they? In the 14th Navy War.
The Americans should have thought about it in Vietnam, I reckon.
But it was just a change, somehow or other.
Yes.
It was a subtle change of events. But I haven't come across it. You see, as you go on soldiering, I will remember the first exercise I ever was on and was cancelled through bad weather.
Right.
It was in 1956.
Right.
Planning off what's called the battalion exercise because the weather was bad. Admittedly, Sue was reservist there.
Right. Yeah.
And I thought, this is not training. This is not good enough.
No. I think that there can be a this is quite an interesting thing. I mean, I'm not talking so much about casualties. There can be there's a line which you have to tread very carefully between cancelling something because the weather is bad and going on because it's good training.
Yeah,
actually,
yes.
I think.
What
I think it is up to the commanding officer to make sure that men are well enough trained to cope with the bad weather. But I think that's the first responsibility. There's no point in taking untrained soldiers into bad weather and saying you can't stand it because the weather's bad.
See, the rum ration would have been cancelled then in any case.
Yeah.
Well, no, it was not on my face. I was in the wrong business.
But you know, you can still rum. This is a funny thing. I mean, I know, being a Royal Marine, but though the Navy has stopped rum, the Army hasn't actually stopped the issue of rum if the commanding officer states that it will, because I've actually, the commanding officer said, we will have a rum issue.
And the medical officer, well, it's supposed to.
Yes, and you just say, right.
Unfortunately, we had a medical officer who looked up Alaris regulation and said, oh, well, a pint of coffee, a pint of cocoa, it's the same.
That's right.
It's the same.
It's the same.
Oh, the morale went down.
But I think you were the one that thing Campbell, you asked you, and you said,
I wasn't there last year. I was on the one in 19... It was last year, 87.
Yes,
did I do the 87 one? No, I didn't. I did the 86 one.
Ah.
Morale in Battle.
Yes, that's
it. I did that one. Yes, and in fact, I'd done the one before that and the one before that, actually.
And are you going this year?
No.
No. I've got my papers in for this year. But one of the questions came up from a student
here
on the things we could buy with it was, did you have any rum during the war?
Any
rum?
Yeah, rum.
Did you sort of pop rum into the
right,
and go?
Yeah.
And in fact, I can never remember having a rum ration ever during the war.
No.
Never.
No, I wouldn't know. I wouldn't have rum. But I had rum in the First World War.
Oh, yeah.
They used to
literally
have rum in the
Start. What do you mean behind that? Because they were giving you Dutch curry, something? This naval chief of the officer came to me, I was called, and
said
that there's a special way of bottling down of Navy officers. If you give me their ration, I will attend to that part of it. And I thought, chief petty officer, equivalent to president of some nations, must be trusted. Yes. And which I did. And he, a couple of his mates, got absolutely negligent.
Yeah, yeah.
And after debrief and everything, you know, planning all sorts of things, thanking everybody for coming and taking the part, and so we hope we'll see you again. And this time, sir, he goes, well, you won't see me again, I can tell you that, you know. He was absolutely legless. Mm. So I lost my name a bit.
Yeah,
you?
Yeah.
Because it's only also do it, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Sad.
Sad.
But then, how many of you would ever have guessed how many of the British Army of the Rhine tested an after one?
Yes, I think there's less than
really.
Are they just as good as they were when you were a young girl?
I think so. It's amazing you could criticize, but I suppose our forebears could criticize us in our turn. The old saying, never as good as in my day, but no, I think they do a damn good job. Would you consider that the same person there changes his uniform, next month he's out in Northern Ireland?
That's right, yeah.
And a lot of people don't realize that, particularly these Americans.
No, they think it's sort of a
toy soldier. What annoyed us, really, was when the Australians were here.
Yeah.
Far to the bicentennial.
Yes.
And in fact, it came across on television.
Mm.
One of the reporter said to an Australian, well, what do you think of the guards? Toy soldiers. Sort of stuff like that. But it was a very, very odd remark, which really he should have thought about. Because it was broadcast, you see.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Typical.
Mm. Well, what do you think?
Yeah. Talking from both sides, you see, because I've done public duties, but not much. But I mean, it requires an incredible amount of self-discipline as well as imposed discipline to do that properly. And it's an excellent
thing. I was watching, funny enough, I was watching, I didn't actually see the troops this year, but I taped it. It's a rather historic one, isn't it?
That's right.
The first for many years, and the last for many years.
To have each representative having seven guards.
That's right. And I was talking to somebody watching forming round, but you know, when they're doing that, every guy has got to be on the ball.
Yes, right.
Because if he isn't, there's a right cocker.
What?
And everyone's thinking and counting and working out what they're going to be doing all the time.
Particularly the mass bands doing this.
That's right. Because
it's not even written down anywhere.
That's right.
But it is a wonderful spectacle.
That's the very time seeing the slope come back, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, yes, lovely that.
Yeah.
Lovely.
Yeah.
The Scots Guards were on here recently when the sound guard was sent for to go up top and demonstrate it to the Queen.
Oh, right, to get her approved, maybe. Yeah.
Well, no, it'd all been done by that
thing. Yeah, right.
Obviously, she'd been reading the press reports or something like that.
Yes.
And she wanted to see the
thing
first time.
I used to say in the birthday presses, they were changing arms as they were falling around.
Yes.
You know.
Well, that's because of the weight of the
weight. It's jolly heavy,
actually. 2,000 pounds in a bit.
Yeah.
And of course, they cannot rest it like we do with our rifles, finding at ease.
Quite. No, they're carrying it all the time.
Right. Yeah. But thinking of arms and all that, if you don't mind, again, this is digression. But we had a company looking after the checkers during the war, and I happened to be the acting company. I was only full sergeant, and I was sent for by the company commander and said, the Prime Minister wants us to carry our rifles across our body, something between a slope and what the French, how they carry their rifles. That went through the motions and produced something, and I went out to the company commander, and he said, that sounds all right. 9 o'clock, outside the front door, so there I was, and the Prime Minister came and he said, good morning, Sergeant, what have you come to show me? I just blurted it out without thinking, The Churchill slope, sir. I mean, no one had told me that. The Churchill slope. So he stood there. Very good, Father. He took his little funny hat off.
Yes, yes.
And away he went. That's how we carried the report our body.
Yes, yeah.
Because
yeah.
Better than having it at the shoulder or over your ready that way.
Yes, it is.
Churchill's love, though.
I'll try to get my hand. Do me a fair swirl. My back tells to a guard and check out.
Anyway, he told the story. He was all set stories of Churchill anyway, wasn't he? That Churchill was very keen that this guard recognized him. So every time they changed over, they had to parade, and he went down, you know. And he said if Churchill made, he didn't make many mistakes, one was that he thought every Englishman was dying to stick his bayonet into the German guts or prisons, you see. So on this guard, he came to a fine young, upstanding guardsman, and apologized, said, I'm very sorry that this onerous duty has been forced upon you when I know much rather be out fighting harm. But this guardsman said, young chap, I'm very happy, sir. He said, I've got my wife down in the village, and this puts me fine, sir. And Churchill said, you wouldn't marry, because he was very young. He said, yes, I'm married, sir, and I've got two children. He said, I know of my wife. And the story goes, boy, I love my cigar, but from time to time I stop and take it out of my mouth. I don't know. You three out very good.
Have you got any photographs? Is that a huge collection of photographs?
Surprisingly.